Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Despite the Trumpian disavowal of climate change, which is perhaps the most egregious example of alternate facts, a report by a consortium of the nation's scientists, the Fourth National Climate Assessment, could not be stonewalled, although the White House chose to release it the day after Thanksgiving, when it was hoped that most Americans would be besotted with Black Friday Christmas shopping and mentally sluggish by turkey tryptophan. The report essentially affirms that the Earth is in imminent danger of soon becoming hostile to human habitation as a result of human civilization, unless we immediately change our undesirable ways. Nearly simultaneous with the report, NASA has landed a space capsule on Mars, which, among other tasks of investigation, might present a few answers as to the planet's historical devolution to its present status as a dead planet. I start today's program with a triplicate pastiche of stuff I have written on the topic, Life in the Greenhouse. Life in the Greenhouse. So now we have made the sun, beloved Sol, the giver of life, our enemy. Its warmth and light are impending death. It is a paradox that we are becoming aware how vital sunlight is to health and psychological well-being, which has always been assumed but never quite as researched as at present. Artificial light is being developed to imitate sunlight, which would probably be necessary for survival if we are forced off the planet's surface into vast gopher holes and underground tunnels and caverns. Of course, being burned up by the sun is only one of the many methods humanity has prompted or devised to obliterate itself, perhaps in submission to some ancient and subliminal apocalyptic prophecy that overhangs succeeding hellish mythologies. The variety of our triggers is exotic: nuclear, biological, or chemical devastation through warfare, of course. But our self-destruction will more likely be a long strangling and baking from a garden of toxic chemicals we have poured and sprayed into the land, sky, ocean, and rivers, which return as acid rain, killer smog, and ozone putrefaction, not to mention other such byproducts as poisoned or irradiated air, soil, and drinking water. Our societies and civilizations are ironically structured on processes that threaten to obliterate them. Our paradox is that the good life is produced by systems and methods that threaten all life. The funniest thing about choking on our affluence is that we think we are so smart. We think we have overpowered nature after centuries of pitiless struggle and are able now to crack the earth with our power. We don't want to give up the good life, the modern life of appliances and holographic reality. We ignore or trivialize warnings that we are fouling our nest, behaving with a false hubris of entitlement that regards humanity as Earth's only patron. Our long feast on Earth's flesh is giving us gas. Mother is biting back. It is probably true that whatever pain the human race causes its home planet, Earth will recover. Homo sapiens will depart in a stink. Our proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem so helpless to undo the damage or change direction. The byproducts of our ways of life are of less concern than our unwillingness to reverse their harm. Our doom will be the result of our lack of intelligent courage to face up to consequences. The terms are quite simple. If we have the moxie, we might survive. If not, we won't. Earth will abide, whichever way we choose. We have built ourselves a global greenhouse, and we dwell within. Greenhouse gases are emitted by human activity and magnify heat radiated back to Earth from an invisible ceiling structured by chemicals released by excessive use of fossil fuels, pesticides, and fluorocarbons that also eat away the upper-level ozone. Beloved Sol heats up our planet at the same time depletion of the ozone screen makes sunlight dangerous. The weather heats up. Summers in particular are increasingly hot and dry. Each summer is the hottest recorded. Desertification is more rampant. Droughts are longer and more frequent, resulting in recurrent famine and intense wildfires. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without charge or cleanup. But the consequences of our careless and excessive self-indulgence are converging. So what can we do about our self-inflicted danger? What will we do about it? Our problems are so vast and complex, the solutions are nearly impossible to agree upon. Yet postponing answers and action leads almost always to denial and rejection of the problems and thus their solutions. The consequences of our ways of life are of less concern than our unwillingness to reverse their harm. We have to stop abusing Earth, but we find infinite rationales for continuing to mutilate it. Draconian measures to reduce air pollution can only buy time and perhaps place a partial ceiling on the ultimate warming. It is already necessary to plan how to cope with the consequences of a hotter world, such as rising seas and abruptly varying weather patterns. We know how to break the pains of our greenhouse jail. Stop clear-cutting Earth's remaining forests and replant logged-over areas. Reduce eventually to zero our reliance on fossil fuel burning in favor of non-polluting energy sources. Stop using toxic defoliants that have, in hardly more than half a century, been absorbed into everything. Strong measures to slow toxic emissions and decrease the inevitable temperature rise are crucial. More than anything else, the most immediate and necessary measure is a change of attitude. We simply have to stop abusing our scarred and sun-blistered Earth. Most adult human beings alive on planet Earth now will most likely not suffer the severe ravages of worsening climate change, perhaps consoling themselves that they will be dead before it really kicks in. Yet perceiving death as the only escape is probably not a satisfactory consolation. And the prospect of each generation being aware the world will be a more dreadful place to live in for each succeeding generation is not much comfort either. Although there is a tremendous political rift in the U.S. about global warming, the real critical partisan divide might be between generations. The more passive elderly who will quit the planet soon, versus the young who want to reverse the probability of a harrowing future now, before it is too late. Another division is whether climate change is anthropogenic, human-caused, or simply a recurrent natural cycle. So we had a United Nations conference on climate change a few years back, number 21, in Paris, another in a succession of gaudy pageants resembling a Star Wars bar, that are more or less emblematic of another great human schism, the disparity between the scornful deceit of power and debilitating impotence of poverty. It would seem a central purpose of these conferences has been the opportunity for those who cause and benefit most from the environmental destruction of the planet to ensure the consequences fall upon those least responsible and most vulnerable. At least global warming was tacitly acknowledged by the principal perpetrators at Paris. An excusable omission is the failure to ensure an equal ratio between women and men as delegates to any of these climate change conclaves. Women's representation should be a fundamental priority. After all, men are the major culprits responsible for the impending global catastrophe that threatens human continuance on this planet. It seems likely that women were the real pioneers of the cultivation of grains and domestication of animals that led to the agricultural revolution that produced civilization. The focal priority of this new century millennium is to complete the public and personal equality of women. It is the essential basic correction for humanity to make, as well as the most potent force to successfully fulfill the myriad other progressive changes, which indeed includes, foremost, the reversal of our present course toward extinction on planet Gaia. If we who are alive now do not sincerely sweat blood to mitigate this dismal trend, our climate distressed descendants will quite likely despise us for cravingly yielding to short-term self-interest. They will probably wish an eternal hell for us to parallel their living hell on earth. And now, I would like to read a couple of articles by Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, beginning with one he wrote for Thanksgiving, Bittersweet. I'm thinking about the many bittersweet events during the first 670 plus days of the Trump administration. So let's talk turkey about what the Donald has done to demonize and demoralize us, while often inspiring us, sometimes at the same time. For example, while his pathetic crusade to gut Obamacare proved woefully unsuccessful, he did motivate millions of Americans to become better informed and enroll in the program. Bittersweet indeed. His attacks on women motivated a million marchers to protest on the day of his inauguration and subsequently to run successfully for office. His Muslim ban, issued just 7 days after his inauguration, motivated concerned Americans to reconsider the import of E pluribus unum, out of many, one, the motto of the United States. Once again, Americans turned into the riveting message of Kizar and Ghazala Khan, a Gold Star family whom Trump denigrated after the loss of their son, Captain Humayun Khan, in Iraq. Trump's hugely reckless June 1, 2017 declaration to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord infuriated millions of us who now vow to do whatever we can to protect our planet. During his visit to Puerto Rico after the hurricane, Trump declared that Maria wasn't a real disaster like Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Of course, our would-be meteorologist displayed no empathy for the 3.2 million brown-skinned Puerto Ricans who had no power or water or much of anything necessary to survive. How sad. But millions of Americans tried to help with cash, donations, prayer, or whatever they could muster. And they continue to help other victims of ravishing forest fires in California and other natural catastrophes. Trump's failure to condemn the white supremacists at the August 12, 2017 Charlottesville protests left a bitter taste, since there was no evidence that there were leftist terrorists or fine people on both sides, both of those being quotes from Trump. His unwillingness to disassociate from Nazis and white power demonstrators, whose violence left one anti-Nazi protester dead and many injured, energized millions of us citizens who value diversity and tolerance. Toss in Trump's selection and ultimate firing of racist Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and, well, you get the picture. Trump is clearly bigoted and incapable of registering even a scintilla of tolerance for people who are different. Witness his reaction to the death of Army Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, killed in Niger on October 4th, 2017. POTUS seemed to discount the death since the sergeant, quote, knew what he signed up for. How pathetic, especially when Trump tried to explain his failure to personally contact Johnson's pregnant widow, Maisha, who claimed that Trump couldn't even remember her dead husband's name. No empathy there, since Trump's only real priority is always what's in it for Trump. The issue of NFL players kneeling during the playing of the national anthem prompted Trump to beat the drum for real patriotism, even though Colin Kaepernick and others who knelt weren't trying to overthrow the government, but were expressing their deep concern for racial justice in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Trump is a pathological liar, as evidenced by evil media like the New York Times, who printed a list of all of Trump's tweeted or otherwise stated lies just between January 20th, 2017 and June 25th the same year. The list required an entire page in very small print. But Trump's skirmishes with facts and truth-telling has inspired millions of us Americans to mobilize, to outmaneuver our egocentric, dim-bulb, short-fingered Bulgarian POTUS. Finally, consider what Trump has done to the English language, savagely mauling it. Incapable of stringing words together in a coherent sentence, Trump has created such mass confusion that his struggle to find the right words seems like a drunk driver smashing into a truck loaded with alphabet soup. Consider this example among many of Trump's dazzling incoherence. Quote, you look at the nuclear deal. The thing that really bothers me, it would have been so easy, and it's not, as important as these lives are. Nuclear is so powerful. My uncle explained that to me many, many years ago, the power, and that was 35 years ago. He would explain the power of what's going to happen, and he was right. Who would have thought? End quote. And the staggeringly futile rambling continues for several more minutes. Can you imagine the headaches Trump language induces as translators struggle to convert the Donald's words into a foreign language? Number 45 has reminded us that President Barack Obama had a way with words, quote unquote. It's obvious that Trump not have any, and that is also a quote. Nonetheless, since listening to Trump speak is such a dizzying experience, many of us realize we need to pursue candor, clarity, and concision in order to combat the deleterious effects of Trump's rhetoric. We all need to use language to effectively mobilize our dissent, and hundreds of groups like Indivisible have already organized to do that. There you have it, my short list of Trump behaviors that paradoxically, have created some real bittersweet moments. I haven't even examined ongoing controversies like the Russia probe, fake news, alternative facts, Betsy DeVos, transgender military personnel, and a treasure trove of other topics. After all, a story told is only a half-hour program. And that was by Dr. Robert Brake. And followed, I will now read something else by him, proudly inarticulate. I know words. I have the best words, gushed candidate Donald Trump at a campaign rally on December 30th, 2015. So move over, Winston Churchill, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, John F. Kennedy, Robert Reagan, and Barack Obama. I taught college classes for 47 years, focusing on public speaking, political communication, persuasion, and American public address. During my career, I conducted a major research on the speeches of Presidents FDR, JFK, and Richard Nixon. And I wrote speeches for Democratic presidential campaigner Hubert Humphrey and a Republican candidate for mayor of Cleveland, Ohio. Along the way, I came to appreciate the eloquence of FDR, JFK, Ronald Reagan, and Barack Obama. But now I'm flummoxed with the truly mind-boggling task of understanding and explaining the garbled rhetoric of Donald J. Trump, with its aggressively, flagrantly, proudly inarticulate violations of our language, something Trump seems to do on purpose while looking up and smiling. How do I decipher his sweet speech patterns, often unencumbered by the thought process and featuring nouns and verbs that seem estranged? How do I, as a speech critic, understand and clearly understand those strange, scary quotes Trump so often uses to distance himself from his words? And how can I explain Trump's tendency to contradict himself twice or more in the same sentence? Tough job. Consider these examples of Trump speak. From the April 17th, 2017 Washington Examiner, a conservative newspaper. I think we've set some incredible foundations going onward with relationships with other countries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Huh? Sorry, losers and haters, but my IQ is one of the highest, and you all know it. Please don't feel so stupid or insecure. It's not your fault. And that was May 18th, 2013. And don't worry, we won't. Grading his first 100 days as president, Trump claimed, I would say communication would be a bit less than A because I don't think we've gotten the word out what we've done because I think we're so busy getting it done that we're not talking about it. April 27th, 2017. Sure, right. Slamming Barack Obama on April 28th, 2015, Trump opined, "Our great African-American president hasn't exactly had a positive impact on the thugs who are so happily and openly destroying Baltimore." I wonder how Obama, the Muslim Kenya-born interloper, would defend himself. How about this terrific May 21st, 2017 history lesson from number 45? Abraham Lincoln, great president. Most people don't even know he was a Republican. Does anyone know? How shocking a revelation, especially to the poorly educated. From the April 28th, 2017 Washington Examiner, "I've passed a lot of legislative bills that people don't even know about." Though, Donald, presidents don't pass bills, they sign them. Oh, well, probably close enough for our leader. Again, from the April 28th, 2017 Washington Examiner, "You know, there are some cases where, like, people are saying, we're being obstructed by the Democrats. Very much so." Yep, opposition parties should never oppose. From a New York Times interview of July 19th, 2017, "The New York Times don't write good. They have people over there, like Maggie Haberman and others. They don't write good. They don't know how to write good." Yet the Donald did invite veteran political correspondent Haberman and two other New York Times writers to interview him. Slam dunk. Finally, consider this doozy from Trump when interviewed by NBC anchor Lester Holt on May 11th, 2017. "When I did this now, I said, I probably, maybe will confuse people. Maybe I'll expand that, you know, lengthen the time, because it should be over with, in my opinion. Should have been over with a long time ago." Dazzling. What could account for Trump's bizarre wordings and convoluted meanderings? A short attention span? Maybe his obsession with winning or his effusive braggadocio? Perhaps Trump's manufactured reality is triggered by a sometimes stoner mind. Who knows? And what about those innumerable cringeworthy remarks, crimes against syntax, and displays of cognitive decline, all bigly causes for concern? Columbia University linguist John McWhorter views Trump as an ordinary barstool speaker, which makes him seem authentic to ordinary people. So what is it about Trump's babbling that so endears him to so many? My answer, they love his banter and don't perceive it as incoherent. Consequently, Trump manages to snooker his audiences into thinking he's actually saying something. Because his style is so confusing, his audience have to pay close attention to make sense of his words. And that need to focus means listeners are more likely to be persuaded, just as you are more likely to be convinced by a lecturer if you pay close attention, rather than letting his or her words drift over you. Consider this example from Trump's announcement of his presidential run on June 15, 2015. "I'll build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me, and I'll build them very inexpensively. Our country is in serious trouble. We don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories, but we don't have them. When was the last time anybody saw us beating, let's say, China in a trade deal? I beat China all the time, all the time." That's just one example of Trump's rambling, incoherent speaking style that makes George W. Bush and Sarah Palin seem Churchillian. George W. Bush, who frequently mangled the English language, at least tried a bit to express himself clearly on occasion, bailed out by speechwriters David Frum and Michael Gerson. And 2008, Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin did manage to be taken seriously by quite a few voters with IQs over 80. I've always believed that a good public speaker should deliver a message that is coherent and understandable. But I've also sensed that a babbling chimpanzee can hold people's attention if it flings enough expletive deleted, even if it is just entertainment. I'm afraid Donald Trump's rhetoric is so bad, there's a sort of grandeur about it. Most of the time, he makes goofy Texan Republican Louis Gohmert and racist Iowa conservative Steve King sound eloquent. Even though Trump's rhetoric remains little else but catchphrases and ill-formed thought, it seems to be working. Maybe future presidential candidates could benefit by not sounding too articulate. Most TV cable show anchors and pundits know that if you can move the needle enough, turn up the decibel level, and repeat, 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 you can snooker a lot of gullible people. Donald Trump knows this too. So, is an articulate American president no longer necessary? Has Trump lowered the bar that much? Stay tuned as we continue to endure the reality show, raucous rhetoric of Donald J. Trump. And that was by Dr. Robert Greig, proudly inarticulate. And another piece by Dr. Greig, Charlottesville Remembered. I'm remembering the horrific violence and hatred spewed on August 11th and 12th, 2017 at Charlottesville, after which Donald Trump appeared to condone the violence and place blame on both sides. I'm also remembering a song from the 1949 production of South Pacific, You've Got to Be Taught. The still relevant lyrics of that then controversial song read, "You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught." Bear those lyrics in mind when so many of the 954 hate groups in America chant, "Jews will not replace us," "White lives matter," and "blood and soil." Clearly, it's time to disengage from hatred. And in addendum, the absurd humbuggery of equivalency of an exodus of impoverished peasants fleeing a corrupt and tyrannical Central American dictatorship, seeking refuge at the U.S. border, with an armed raid into New Mexico in 1916 with Pancho Villa and his revolutionary bandit army that killed nearly 20 Americans, would be laughable if it were not so benignantly odious. Students of irony might suppress a groan to remember that 30 years ago this past Monday, on November 26, 1988, KMUN broadcast an NPR report on what was claimed to be the final reunion of the last surviving veterans of the Mexican Revolution that began in 1910, which included a few who had ridden with Pancho Villa. Villa's youngest daughter, who was then in her 70s, one of many children of multiple wives, translated for the remaining Villaistas, one of whom, 90 at the time of the reunion, had initially enlisted in the Federal Army in anger at the U.S. assault on Veracruz in 1914. Instead, he had been sent against Villa's insurrectos and was captured and given a choice of changing sides or hanging. Villa apparently made him a captain. Villa's surviving revolutionary brigands, there seemed to be only four of them at the reunion, voiced contempt at Mexico's single-party rule that the revolution failed to dispel. These weathered old veterans, as the NPR radio jock described them, said Mexico needed a new Pancho Villa, that the country was still governed by descendants of the people Porfirio Diaz, the dictator that they deposed, made rich. The organizer of the reunion lamented to NPR, "There will never be another reunion of the soldiers of the Mexican Revolution." Oregon's great revolutionary journalist, John Reed, who was present at two major revolutions, the other was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. His book about that, 10 Days That Shook the World, made him world famous, rode with Pancho Villa, whose real name was Doroteo Arango, wrote about Villa's dream of a Mexican Republic in his 1914 book, Insurgent Mexico. "When the new republic is established, there will never be any more army in Mexico," Villa said. "Armies are the greatest support of tyranny. There can be no dictator without an army." Villa's revolutionary amigo, Emiliano Zapata, expressed essentially the same. "A strong man makes a weak people. A strong people doesn't need a strong man." Both were murdered by assassins of their opponents, as was their revolutionary godfather and patron saint, Francisco Madero, whom they helped elect president in 1911. Madero was assassinated in 1913, half a century before American President John F. Kennedy's assassination in 1963. Now, that might be considered a sort of equivalency. And as epilogue, 70 years ago this past Sunday, November 25th, 1948, Ed Parsons of Astoria, Oregon, who ran a radio station in the city, invented cable TV. There is a plaque up at the Astoria Column commemorating this momentous moment. Sunday, November 25th, was also International Day to Eliminate Violence Against Women. And 99 years ago yesterday, on November 28, 1919, American-born Lady Nancy Astor became the first woman to be elected to the British Parliament House of Commons. Lady Astor was repeatedly re-elected for her impassioned support of women's and children's rights. She retired in 1945 and died in 1964. This is Michael McCusker.